Chapter 2nd, the 16th century. Topic: the influence of the Renaissance on English literature. Introduction. It is difficult to date or define the Renaissance. Etymologically, the term, which was first used in England only as late as the 19th century, means rebirth. Broadly speaking, the Renaissance implies that were awakening of learning which comes to Europe in the 14th and 15th century. The Renaissance was not only an English but a European phenomenon, and basically considered, it symbolized a thorough substitution of medieval habit of thought by new attitude. The dawn of Renaissance came first to Italy and a little later to France, to England to come much later. Roughly about the beginning of the 16th century, as we have said at the outset, it is difficult to date the Renaissance. However, it may be mentioned that in Italy, an impact of Greek learning was first felt when, after the Turkish consequent Constantinople, the Greek scholar fled, the took refuge in Italy, carrying with them a vast treasure of ancient Greek literature in manuscript. The study of this literature fired the soul of imagination of the Italy of that time and created a new kind of intellectual and aesthetic culture quite different from that of the Middle Age. The Little and the Renaissance come very slowly to the isolated Iceland of England. So what when it did come in all its brilliance in the 16th century, the Renaissance and Italy had already become a spent force. It is difficult to define the Renaissance, but its broadly implication in England do not defy discussion. Michels exaggeratedly calls the Renaissance discovered by mankind to himself and of the world. This is indeed too sweeping. More correctly, we can say that the following are the implication of Renaissance in England. The first, the Renaissance means the depth of medieval scholasticism, which had for long been keeping human thought in bondage. The schoolmen got themselves entangled in useless controversies and tries to apply the principle of Aristotelian philosophy to the doctrines of Christianity, thus giving birth to a vast literature characterized by polemic, casuistry and sophistry, which did not advance man in any way. Secondly, it symbolized a revolt against spiritual authority, the authority of the Pope. The Reformation, though not a part of the revival of learning, was yet a companion movement in England. This defiance and spiritual authority went hand in hand with that of intellectual authority. Renaissance intellectuals distinguished themselves by their flagrant anti-authoritarianism. Thirdly, the Renaissance implied a greater perception of beauty and polis in the Greek and Latin scholars. This beauty and this polis were sought by Renaissance men to later to be incorporated in their narrative literature. Further, it means the birth of a kind of imitative tendency employed in the term classicism. Lastly, the Renaissance marked a change from the theocentric of the homocentric conception of universe. Human life pursued the even body came to be glorified. Human life, as G. H. Mayer observed in inverted comma, which the medieval church had taught them, the people, to regard but as a threshold and a stepping stone of eternity, acquired suddenly a new mountainousness and value, inverted comma close, the otherworldliness gave place to this worldliness. Human values came to be recognized as permanent values, and they were sought to be enriched, to illuminate by the heritage of antiquity. This bred a new kind of paganism and marked the rise of humanism, as also by implication materialism. Let us now consider the impact of Renaissance on the various departments of English literature. Non-creative literature. Naturally, the first impact of the Renaissance in England was registered by the universities, being the repositories of all learning. Some English scholars, becoming aware of the revival of learning in Italy, went to that country to benefit by it and examine personally the manuscript brought there by the failing Greek scholar, and Constantinople. Prominent among these scholars were William Grayson, 1446 to 1519, Thomas Linacre, L-I-N-A-C-R-E, 1416 to 1524, the John Collett, 1467 to 1519. After returning from Italy, they organized the teaching of Greek in Oxford. They were such learned and reputed scholar of Greek that Erasmus came all the way from Holland to learn Greek from them. Apart from scholars, the impact of Renaissance is also in a measure to be seen on the work of the educationist of the age. Sir Thomas Eliot, E-L-Y-O-T, 1490 to 1546, wrote The Governor, 1531, which is a treatise on moral philosophy, modeled on Italy work and full of the spirit of Roman antiquity. Other educationists were Sir John Cheke, C-H-E-K-E, 1415 to 1557, Sir Thomas Wilson, 1525 to 1581, and Sir Roger Ascham, A-S-C-H-A-M, 1515 to 1668. Out of all the educationists, the last named is most important on account of his schoolmaster published 2 years after this death, his death. Therein he puts forward his view on the teaching of classics. His own style is too obviously based upon the ancient Roman writer. By turns, remark Lewis, his limits Cicero, periods and Seneca, nervous consciousness. In addition to these well-known educationists, must be mentioned the sizable number of now obscure one. Those many unacknowledged, unknown guide who in school and university were teaching men to admire and imitate the masterpiece of antiquity, Lewis. The next topic, prose. The most important prose writer who exhibit well the influence of the Renaissance of English prose are Erasmus, Sir Thomas More, Lilly and Sidney. The first named was Dutchman who, as we have already said, come to Oxford to learn Greek. His chief work was The Price of Folly, which is English translation of the most important work written in England. It is, according to Tucker Brook, the best expression in literature of the attack that the Oxford reformer were making upon the medieval system. Erasmus wrote this work in 1510 at the house of his friend Sir Thomas More, who was executed at the bidding of Henry VIII for his refusal to give up of his allegiance to the Pope. More, the famous prose romance Utopia, was in the word of Lewis, true prologue to the Renaissance. It was the first book written by the Englishman which achieved European fame, but it was written in Latin 1516 and only later 1555 was translated into English. Curiously enough, the next work by an Englishman again to acquire European fame, Bacon Novum Originum, was also written originally in Latin. The word Utopia is from Greek O-U-T-O-P-O-S, Outops, meaning no place. More, a Utopia is an imaginary Iceland which is the habitat of an ideal republic. By the picture of the ideal state of implied a kind of social criticism of contemporary England. More's indebtedness to Plato's Republic is quite obvious. However, more seems also to be indebted to the then recent discoveries of the explorer of navigators like Columbus and Vasco da Gama, who were mostly the Spanish and Portuguese nationalities. In Utopia, more discredits medievalism in all its implication and exalts the ancient Greek culture. Lewis observed about this work: the Utopians are in revolt against the spirit of chivalry. They hate warfare and despise soldiers. Communism is the law of the land. All are workers for only a limited number of hours. Life should be pleasant for all. Asceticism is condemned. More relies on the godliness of human nature and intones a hymn to the glory of the sense which reveal nature's wonder in Utopia. All religion are authorized and tolerance is the law. Scholasticism is scoffed at. The Greek philosophy preferred to that of Rome. From one end to the other of the book, More reverse medieval beliefs. More's Utopia created a new genre in which can be classed such works of Bacon's The New Atlantis, 1626, Samuel Butler's Erewhon, 1872, W.H. Mallock and New Republic, 1877, Richard Jefferies After London, 1885, W.H. Hudson, The Crystal Age of 1887, William Morris, The New Form, Nowhere, and W.H. Wells, A Modern Utopia, 1905. Passing on the prose writer of Elizabethan is the age of the flowering of the Renaissance, we find them markedly influenced both in their style and thought content by the revival of the antique classic learning, Sidney and Arcadia, Lilly and Euphues, Euphues, the hooker in the law of ecclesiastical polity, write an English which is away from language to common speech and is either too heavily laden, as in case of Sidney and Lilly, with bits of classical finery or modeled on Latin syntax. As in the case of Hooker, Cicero seems to these writers a very obvious and respectable model. Bacon, however, in his sententiousness and cognacy, comes near Tacitus, Tacitus, and turns away from the prolixity, diffuseness, and ornamentation associated with Ciceronian prose. Further, in his own career and his essay, Bacon stands as a representative of the materialistic Machiavellian facet of the Renaissance, particularly the Renaissance Italy. He combines in himself the dispassionate pursuit of truth and the keen desire for material advance. Poetry, next topic. Sir Thomas Watt, W-A-T-T, 1502 to 1442, and the Earl of Surrey, Surrey, 1517 to 1547, were pioneer of the new poetry of England. After Chaucer, the spirit of English poetry has slumbered up for upward of a century. The change in pronunciation in the 15th century had created a lot of confusion in prosody, which in the practice of such important poet of Lydgate and Skelton had been reduced to a mockery. The revival, as the Lewis says, was an uphill task. Verse had to be drawn from the longus to which it had sunk in Stephen Hawes, and from disorder in which a Skelton had plunged it. All had to be done anew. It was a W-Y-A-T-T and Surrey who come forward to do it. As Mayer put it, it is with these two courtiers that the modern English poetry began. Though they wrote much earlier, it was only in 1557, a year before Elizabeth's coronation, that their work was published in Total Miscellany, which is, according to G.S. Mayer, one of the landmarks of English literature. Of the two, Wyatt had travelled instinctively in Italy and France and had come under the spell of Italian Renaissance. It must be remembered that the work of Wyatt, W-Y-T-T, the Surrey, does not reflect the impact of the Rome and antiquity alone, but also that of modern Italy, so far as versification is concerned. Wyatt and Surrey imported into English various new Italian metrical pattern. Moreover, they gave English poetry a new sense of grace, dignity, delicacy and harmony, which was found by them lacking in the works of Chaucer and the Chaucerian likes. Further, they were highly influenced by the love poetry of Petrarch, and they did their best to imitate it. Petrarch's love poetry is of the courtly kind, in which the pining lover is shown as a servant of his mistress, with his heart tempest tosses by the neglect and his mood varying according to her absence and presence. There is much of idealism in, if not downright artificiality, in this kind of love poetry. It goes to the credit of Wyatt to have introduced the sonnet into English literature, and to Surrey to have first written blank verse. Both the sonnet and blank verse were later to be practiced by a vast number of best English poets. According to the David Dessay, Wyatt's sonnets represent one of the most interesting movements toward metrical discipline to be found in English literary history. Though in his sonnet he did not employ regular iambic pentameters, yet he created a sense of discipline among the poet of his time, who had forgotten the lesson and example to Chaucer and like Skelton were writing rest and jagged line which jarred so unpleasantly upon the ear. As Tillyard puts it, Wyatt led the Renaissance into English verse by importing Italian and French pattern of sentiment as well as versification. He wrote in all 32 sonnets, out of which 17 are adaptation of Petrarch. Most of them, 28, have the rhyme scheme of Petrarch's sonnet, that it each has the octave A B B A A B B A, and 26 out of these 28 have a C D D C E E sestet. Only in the last three he comes near what is called the Shakespearean formula, that is three quatrains and a couplet. In the 13 sonnets he exactly produced his sonnets rhymes A B A B A B A B A B A B C C. Surrey wrote about 15 or 16 sonnet, out of which 10 use of Shakespearean formula, which was to enjoy the greatest popularity among the sonneteers of 16th century. Surrey's work is characterized by the exquisite grace, the tenderness which we find missing from that of Wyatt. Moreover, he is better craftsman and gives greater harmony to his poetry. Surrey employed blank verse in his translation of the fourth book of the Aeneid, A-E-N-E-I-D, the work which was first translated into English verse by Zevin Douglas a generation earlier, but in heroic couplet. The drama topic, drama. The revival of ancient classical learning scored its first clear impact on English drama in the middle of 16th century. Previous to this impact, there had been a pretty vigorous native tradition of drama, particularly comedy. This tradition had its origin in the liturgical drama and had progressed through the miracle and the mysteries, and later the morality and the interlude. John Heywood had written a few vigorous interludes, but They were altogether different in tone, spirit and purpose from Greek and Roman drama of antiquity. The first English regular tragedy, Gorboduc, G-O-R-B-O-D-U-C, written by Sackville and Norton and first acted in 1562. And comedy Ralph Dresden, written about 1550 by Nicholas Udall, U-D-A-L-L, were very much imitation to of classical tragedy of comedy. It is interesting to note that English dramatist came not under the spell of ancient Greek dramatist A-E-S-C-H-Y-L-U-S. Aeschylus, Sophocles and Euripides, the tragedy writers, and Aristophanes, the comedy writers. But the Roman dramatist Seneca, the tragedy writer, and the Plautus and the Trinus, the comedy writers. It was indeed unfortunate, as Greek drama is vastly superior to Roman drama. Gorboduc is a Slavian imitation of Senecan tragedy and has all its features without much of its life. Like Senecan tragedy, it has revenge as the tragic motive, as most of its important incident, mostly murder, narrated on the stage, is messenger. As much of rhetoric and verbose declamation as a ghost among its dramatist person, and so forth. It is indeed a good instance of the blood and thunder. King of tragedy, Ralph Dresden, is modeled upon Plautus and Terence. It is based on the stupid endeavors of the hero from winning the love of married woman. There is a cunning Mary Slav Matthew Mary Greek, a descendant of Plautian, P-L-A-U-T-I-N-E, Slav, who serves the motive power which keeps the play going. Later on, the university wits struck a note of independence in their dramatic works. They refused to copy Roman drama as slavishly. As the writers of Gorboduc and Dresden, even so, their plays are not free from the impact of the Renaissance. Rather, they saw it as imply, though not in the same way. In their imagination, they were all fired by this new literature, which showed them new dimensions of human capability. They were humanist through and through. All them, Lilly, Green, Pelle, Nasse, Laws, Marlowe and Kidd, so in their dramatic work not. Of course, a slavish tendency to ape the ancient, but a chemical action of Renaissance learning on the native genius, fired by the enthusiasm of discovery and aspiration so typical of the Elizabethan age. In this respect, Marlowe stands in the forefront of the university wits. Rightly has he been called the two child of the Renaissance. Topic over.